Good evening, James McCann here with my Science Hour for May 16, 2024, and goodness, how this year is flying by. Like those old movies where they show the calendar and the wind is blowing the pages by, the weeks, the months, that's what's going on. Time acceleration, some kind of time warp. Okay, tonight I'm going to talk about a little bit about ethics in publication, something that's germane to all of us, something that's really important and has been lost, unfortunately, in the kind of cowcowing to the ivory tower residents of our great country, and it's kind of a unwritten law amongst them that they can, in fact, let me just tell you a story. They can do what they want, but let me tell you a little story just to put this into perspective. This is not something new. When I was at Cornell in the 1979-81 time frame, I was publishing my books. I had a very large book that all of these papers came out of, and then some of the papers. And the person that was typing for me, this is back in the old days, you did not have computers or terminals, you did not have equipment that was automated. Things got typed on typewriters. And if there was an error of some kind, they had to retype the entire page. They could not use whiteout. Because when you sent this paper into an editor, into a journal, it had to be perfect because they didn't, some whiteouts were not complete, so that they really didn't, and then somebody would type over it, was not clear, so they required perfect, like perfection from the secretaries typing these papers. And I had a woman who was a secretary at Cornell, and she made extra money by typing scientific papers for people. She was in the physics department. Her name was Marie Jones. And she was a nice little old lady, lived out in a trailer house outside of Ithaca, and made her living as a secretary at Cornell. And I don't think they paid very well because her standard of living was not very high, let's put it that way. But anyway, she typed my papers that you will see published in peer-reviewed journals, etc., some of the other follow-on papers, etc., that eventually were blocked. But she was telling me stories that she said that Carl Sagan, one of the big complaints of the graduate students there is that these professors would take material developed by the grad students and publish it as original work. And so when you see people with hundreds of publications, they didn't do that all by themselves. A lot of it was done and developed in production, everything, by other people. And they get credit. They get their name on it. And that's the kudos of being a hotshot at a big name university. So this has been going on for a long time, people taking credit for somebody else's work. And you might think that this has to do with copyrights. Copyrights really don't protect much at all, if you understand. And legally, they protect even less. It's very, very thin protection. So when people get a copyright, actually the work is copyrighted as soon as it is produced and becomes publicly available. It's automatically copyrighted. You literally don't have to send in a form or whatever because the copyright states that you... the copyright law states that you simply have the copyright when the work is produced. But it's really loose, and it does not offer the author very much protection, whether it's music, whether it's written work, or whatever. So anyway, there's another issue of... So there's the copyright issue, and that is what that really protects is someone taking your book and printing it and selling it. That's kind of what it protects against. Nothing, not a lot more. And in terms of content or in terms of what I do in terms of mathematical or my space science theoretical work, etc., a copyright is not very good protection. However, in the world of publication, there's a thing which are ethical standards. Now, this is a whole different ballgame where there should be referencing. And so with the Wild West on the internet today, all kinds of people are running around making claims, and you have all these YouTubers that thousands and thousands of them that have no scientific background running around making predictions, and a lot of them basing it on my work, but extracting things, making wild claims. But the whole issue of ethical standards is one of referencing, where you have to something, and this is, I'm talking about serious science and mathematics, that if there's a pre-existing work, you should reference it. There are things that people do like, oh, well, I was basing my work on some previous work, therefore I don't have to reference you. No, that's not how it works. And that is done by scammers, basically plagiarists, people who plagiarize. And then, because clearly if they reference the real source where they got the information, namely my work, it would expose them as frauds, which they are. So that's their lying, cheating way around that, it's called leapfrog referencing. NASA does it all the time. NASA has been famous for stealing bits and pieces of my work over the decades, and then leapfrog referencing and going, oh, back in 1974, somebody said such and such, and then they use that reference as if this had been common knowledge all along. So I just want to let you know that in the world of peer review and peer review publications, or in just any kind of publication, even if it's not peer reviewed, some of the journals that do not require peer review, where people just post their own articles, etc., you run into this ethical issue where if somebody's made aware of a pre-existing work, then they're told about this, they understand it, then they should be referencing the pre-existing work. It's a courtesy, it's an ethical issue, and these standards are not upheld, unfortunately, especially by the journals who should be enforcing these, but they fail to do this because they're afraid that somebody might not publish in their journal, that they might get a bad reputation. It's kind of like the news media with NASA. Nobody in the news media will ever say anything bad about NASA. Why? Because if they do, they won't get the next story. NASA won't go to them and give them an interview or whatever. And they will be chopped out. And if they're journalists, science journalists, they'll be simply chopped out of the picture. And they won't get any more stories or airtime from NASA. So NASA has kind of this resiliency, kind of Teflon resiliency, where they can slip and slide and make scientific claims, steal material from other authors, claim that they own the data, and only the principal investigators can use it to make discoveries, and only their principal investigators can make discoveries. I mean, this is goofy. And then some clown like Neil deGrasse Tyson comes along and says that we have all of this data and you don't, therefore we're right and you're wrong. Incredible slip-slide, that's the best thing you could call it. It's the kind of thing that would happen in kindergarten or first grade, when kids are first starting to learn how to interact and somebody's a bully. It's a form of bullying, where you take something, you call it your own. It's like the kid at the ballpark when you were little playing ball, that if he didn't get a home run or you got tagged out, he'd get mad, throw a bat, take the ball, leave. And everybody else is standing there like, hey, you got to play by the rules. You can't move the goalpost. You can't move home plate for your benefit. And so when people get older and they do this kind of thing, then there's, and they're in charge of something like a peer-reviewed journal or a scientific publication, then all of a sudden you have people that are unethical and they're very staunch about it. They do not have, they don't have ethics, and it's in their favor. Everything is always in their favor. They get to move the home base closer to them, so when they run in from third base, they score every time. Okay, this kind of leads into the next topic, which is those resilient to survive. Now, the world today is in one of the biggest man-made messes ever. We don't have impending Planet X. We don't have, you know, a comet Venus coming by that's going to ravage Earth. They're talking about this asteroid that might whiz by Earth in 2029 type of thing. And then it might come back in another 70 years, maybe. I don't know. So a lot of hype on that. But literally today, the world is not beset by some kind of astronomical disaster. Something that could change tomorrow, could change tonight at midnight. But at the current time, the human race is not beset with a Noah's flood impending or something like that. And by the way, the reason Noah knew about the flood coming is because he knew about the comet. That is because Earth, the Noah's flood, was Earth passing through the tail of a comet. So there were people at the time that knew about this, and somebody tipped off Noah. So he's out building this ark and getting ready, and all the people are laughing at him until the rain starts falling. Okay. But, you know, don't look at that movie with Russell Crowe. I like a lot of Russell Crowe movies, but that was one of the worst ones ever, where the water comes shooting up out of the ground. Good grief, Hollywood, please. No, it was 40 days and 40 nights, or a long time of torrential rain. But, okay, who survived? Getting back to my main point here. Who survived? The resilient and the people that understood things. There were no guarantees. Let me just put it that way. During the Noah's flood, for example, Noah was not the only dude that survived. There were people up in the Hindu Kush. There were people in the, you know, in the Himalayas. There were people mainly in mountainous areas, the Andes. You know, you find the Peruvian, the Incas eventually growing out of that and having their history well documented. So that's an important point because, say, for example, when Belikovsky did his work, these civilizations passed through with writing, and they were able to pass this information and with a developed language. These were not just cavemen making grunting noises, like, rah, rah, rah. You know, that's the impression that you get when you learn about modern archaeology. They talk about these population centers growing, and it's like man all of a sudden just popped out and was on Earth here from some kind of evolutionary stage, you know, maybe 6,000 years ago or something, and now they're trying to push it back, of course, because their story doesn't make any sense, and it's becoming obvious. So standard archaeology is trying desperately to push the date back because their story about how man developed in a valley of Mesopotamia and grew out of there to cover the entire globe, you know, crossing the Bering Strait and then populating the Western Hemisphere, what is now the Western Hemisphere, you know, just doesn't make any sense. But even as they build the story today, but anyway, back to the main topic of who were the people that survived. I think we're going to learn a valuable lesson from them. Today, like I say, this is not. I'm not talking about something imminent in the next year. You know, go out and buy a piece of land and go completely primitive, because there's, you know, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that in the future, something's going to happen. It might be 10,000 years from now. It might be 100 years from now. It might be next week. We don't know. We don't really have a plan because All of the information about solar system objects, like out in the Kuiper Belt, that could have orbits that come into the inner solar system, we don't know about. NASA ain't talking. They shut up, you know, many, many years ago when they discovered over 1,000 new planets out there. We don't know what their orbits are. The assumption is that they're all way out there and their orbits are all way out there and they'll never come in here. But that's just, you know, it doesn't make any sense. But anyway, we don't have any real information. But back to the topic of who survived the last major event, which was the Venus event. Prior to that, a number of thousands of years earlier, the Noah's event, the Great Flood. And these were worldwide population mass extinctions, literally. Large populations of the world just went under overnight. But when you see this, you see the remnants that grew into the Incas, that grew into the Mayas. The ancestors were the Olmecs. Very Polynesian looking. Very Polynesian. Then you have real intelligent people like Thor Heyerdahl, who said, hey, these people living in Central South America, the Incas, the remnants of the Maya, etc., don't look anything like the Chinese. So this idea that, or the Mongolians, so this idea that somehow the populations crossed the Bering Strait and populated the Western Hemisphere. In fact, the North American Native American populations look absolutely nothing like the Chinese. So that idea is, it never made any sense. It never had any inkling of sense ever, but it was taught for, you know, it's what they taught us in grade school, and I'm sure people got A's on tests by repeating that garbage, just like they're doing today. That's still being taught. Good grief, you know. But what this tells us, the whole story is that pockets of civilizations of people that looked very different went under during those last two major events on Earth, 6,000 years ago and about 3,500 years ago. That's about the time frame. And I'm not giving exact dates. I'm just giving you kind of rough time frames. And they were both comet-related events. But the people who survived, number one, the majority were up in the mountains. Noah built a big boat, put animals on it, and when the rain started coming and the thing, it just floated away. He didn't move it. He waited for the waters to rise, lift it up, and carry it out into the, you know, floated in the ocean until they say the waters receded. Well, in a sense, they receded. They were the torrential rains were washing down into the ocean beds all the time, and then because also the sun was blotted out, there was a lot of glaciation at that time. The same with the Venus event. So just to be clear, the Noah's flood was just rain, like torrential rain. If you've ever been in a torrential rainstorm, it's raining so hard you can hardly breathe. If you get under something, I mean, it's like buckets coming down of rain, just continual rain, like the sky is just full of water. That's what it was like for, they say, 40 days and 40 nights. Those biblical numbers, 40, just means many. 1, 2, 3, 10, 20, 30, 40, many. And so 40 is the biggest number that the average person could understand in those days. Like Carl Sagan would say, billions and billions. Well, nobody really has an idea. Unless you're a pretty good mathematician, what a billion is, what does it really mean? It's just a big number, you know, and so billions and billions means a really big number. And that's what 40 days and 40 nights meant in the Bible. There's all kinds of references to 40 days and 40 nights. And that doesn't literally mean 40 days, no. It means a long time, more than you can count or remember. Okay, and so what happens is during these events, I mean, the Earth is under attack. During the Venus event, you had a pole shift, you had mountain building, you had tsunamis, big tsunamis. the Mayans talk about Quetzalcoatl taking the ocean, and they have it personification where Quetzalcoatl and his partner are carrying the oceans on their back. One thing you can say for sure is that in both of those cases, the people living near the coastline, in other words, the big population centers, of which they were fairly large prior to the Moses event, the Venus event, the Velikovsky event, that's the one that Velikovsky talks about, is Venus, the large comet coming by Earth. We know it was two times because of the Mayans, the Popol Vuh. That the, you know, all of the different effects, we know about those because the ancients all over the world talk about them. But the end result is that, you know, the big populations, just like now, of Earth were living near the coastlines of the ocean, ocean coastlines and lake coastlines, etc. But any coastline was greatly affected by both of these events. The flood, the ocean levels rose hundreds of feet. And so that would have been the same for large lake areas. They would have risen the coastlines, and so those populations, look at the Great Lakes. Surrounding the Great Lakes are cities. You know, and if you get away from those, you don't find many cities. They're on waterways, like for the eastern cities, like in Ohio, and other locations are on rivers. And so those would have changed. The vast majority of people today live near water of some kind, oceans, lakes, rivers, and then the smaller populations live away from them. So take a city like Chicago, which is on the on Lake Michigan. It's, you know, that whole population in a 200-foot rising of the ocean levels, all that population of Chicago would be gone. There wouldn't be a drop left of population there. And it hit so hard is the and there's no place to go. You have around Chicago area all plains. You know, it's all flat until you get up into Wisconsin where you have some hills, but really not much. And so the first thing you don't want to be is near the coastline. You have some major cities in the United States, like, say, the Kansas cities. There might be some, like, say, Vegas is not on a body of water, a man-made body of water nearby Lake Mead, but not natural. And they picked, interesting enough, Vegas was picked as a recreation spa in the middle of the desert, specifically for the people in Los Angeles, so they could have a couple-hour drive, go to Vegas, party, drink, and then go back home. But Vegas is, of course, a population center. A lot of people live there, and most people are catering to the tourist population. But it's not what you would call a national large population center. You've got a place like Denver. It's not on any body of water. But it's a hub traditionally right before you get to the mountains. But there again, Denver is, you know, it's a city, but it doesn't have that large a population compared to a worldwide population. 90% of the world population today lives near the coastline of a lake, mainly the oceans, or major river or major lake. Like we have the Great Lakes in the United States. The same with Canada. You have the major cities in the east, and then in the west, on the west coast, right on the ocean. You know, and then they're the majority of the population of Canada or any other country, the same. Russia is interesting in that it is not the case. They don't have a lot of water frontage in the major cities in Russia. Okay, but anyway, so the one place you don't want to be is near an ocean or body of water. But like I say, if you live near the Atlantic Ocean or something, don't quick sell your house based on what I'm saying, because we don't have any major impending issues coming, except unless the Canary Islands cut loose and create a big tsunami, which has happened, and wipes out the entire eastern seaboard of the United States with a six-hour notice, for which nobody is prepared. But okay, so being in the right place or being in the wrong place would be critical to your survival of some kind of major event from outer space. But there's the other aspect of survival. Okay, after the initial event, then what do you do? Okay, now you stand there with your finger up your nose because you don't have any food, you don't have any preparation, you've got many mouths to feed, you don't have any place to go, your house has been destroyed. It's a big mess. So the number of people then that are going to survive 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks is going to be pretty small. The population, if you didn't die in the major event, then, you know, you're probably going to die afterwards. It's kind of like nuclear war. You know, so many people die initially, but then in weeks following it, that's why nobody is a winner with a nuclear war, because, you know, with time, eventually everybody's going to have a hard time surviving because of the radiation and everything, all of the after effects, you know, the lack of food, the lack of clean water, the lack of resources that they're used to having. And so that would be the other thing, is who's going to be able to survive. So anyway, one thing I've always done in my life is I have a foot on both sides of the fence. I could go primitive in a given day, and I spend a lot of my time living a very primitive lifestyle with very minimal amount of modern, you know, luxuries or modern items. And the other time, I go on trips, I travel, I go to nice places, I go to places that aren't so nice. So all kinds of things. And so I have this, I have a balance in my life, but I could switch back and forth between these on a given day and not even blink an eye. Most people cannot do that. In fact, it gives rise to the basically the ugly American who's in a foreign country, and, you know, they make fun of the currency, that funny play money of that other country, or they make fun of the people because they're poor, and they just... You know, they're living basically off the land, and they're very poor people. But they probably eat a lot better and a lot healthier than Americans. You know, they don't have the grocery store where they go and all the apples are exactly the same size, perfectly set up on the in the vegetable counter and the fruit counter of the grocery store. They don't have that. But what they have, you know, because all those apples are full of chemicals that are going to make you sick eventually. But we also have very, very good examples of people who survived the major event, the last one. For example, what we call the ancient Greeks. What we call the ancient Greeks started about maybe 500 BC, where they started emerging. Actually, Rome had its roots around that same time when the Greeks were flourishing, but that's 1,000 years after the Venus event. So who were the Greeks? The people that actually survived the event and created the pantheon of gods, which were attributed to all kinds of things, Jupiter, Zeus, Apollo, the sun god, etc., this pantheon of deities for the Greeks, because they understood nature through this pantheon of gods. But that came from very intelligent groups of people, and the Greeks were very intelligent. The precursors to literally all of the civilizations were highly intelligent, well-developed groups. But it got sent back to the cave ages. Some of them developed more rapidly than others. The Arabs developed the counting system and a lot of technology that is still in use today. The base 10 number system comes from the Arabic, the lettering, the writing, the language that was developed by the Greeks, by the Arabs, and a lot of that culture we still use today, mathematics. But 1,000 years earlier, these people were coming out of the cave ages, and the question is, who were those people that survived this major event? And it turns out, with the Greeks, they were people living up in the mountains. They were sheep herders. So they were educated but also living on a very simple basis so that their life, here's the key. Whose life is going to change the most? So if you have the woke culture in the United States as the epitome of people who would not survive a day because they depend on everything being handed to them. They're very pampered people. Let's just put it that way. And everything is for them and you know, kind of handed to them on a golden platter. And that's one of the characteristics of people that are pampered when they're raised is they're eccentric. You know, everything's got to be their way. And they can demand something just because they feel that way at this time, and everybody's got to jump for them. That's wokeism in a nutshell. But those people wouldn't last a New York second in terms of resiliency to change. Rapid change, those people would be gone in a New York second. A lot of people that think they're resilient would be gone very quickly also. The people living the lifestyle where they're growing their food, where, let's just put it this way, all of their food comes from within 1 mile of where they live. Those are the people that have the best chance of survival. Can you say that? And I'm not talking about the grocery store where you get your food. I'm talking about it's raised and without chemicals, without modern equipment, without any help that you would consider modern. That would be the biggest thing is food and fresh water, and they're used to their environment. Those would be the people who would have the very highest chance of survival. As the farther you get away from that norm of having all of your food and what you would construct a small hut with, like wood or other local materials, whether it be earth-type houses, block, stone, locally grown materials like wood-like materials or fiber materials. Literally everything you need currently to survive comes from within 1 mile. That's basically walking distance or the distance you can carry something. And the less, you know, if it's within a half mile, that increases your chances even more. The thing about the people living up in the caves, the Greeks, is they had protection from all this stuff that came in when the comet was passing by. They talk about the rain of brimstone and fire. They talk about the meteor showers. And this is not just meteors. This is big chunks of stuff that came raining in from the sky, from the comet passing by. You also have volcanoes going off. The earth was rocking and rolling. And so there's an element of luck. Are you downwind from a major volcano? And volcanoes just don't go off straight up. When they blow out sideways typically. So are you in the path? In fact, recently I was in an area that had been just bombarded with rocks. So all over the countryside, there's these massive rock fields on big boulders. And those were blown out of a volcano. And there may be some places on Earth, and they talk about this in the Mideast, there are places where the whole land is covered with basically things that came in from outer space, meteors, meteorites, large chunks of rock material that are associated with a large comet. Okay, so, being in a cave or some kind of underground shelter, and you find these all over the world where people survived, animals survived, etc., basically were survival zones. And these groups then grow out. I did a mathematical analysis regarding population development. And if you took a small population, I think what we started with was 50 people, mathematical analysis, and that you doubled it every 10 years. And what would happen after 100 years? The 50 people would populate or grow in population 250,000. This is after 100 years. This is doubling the population every 10 years. After 200 years, you would have 26 million people. This is a normal growth rate in third world countries today. So that's a normal growth rate, and when the people tend to populate more under these stressful conditions. It's just the way it is. So then in another 100 years, you would be up to a world population of around 13 billion people. So this is, and that's in 300 years after starting with a group of 50 people, okay? So the world repopulation does not take that long. And of course, those are ideal numbers, and ideal numbers in the actual repopulation of the Earth. If you look at the 1800s, people had, a lifespan of 30 years. So there's the issue of hard times. Where do you get the food from to support these people? The other factors that limit growth. But just from a strictly genetic point of view perspective, the populations can grow rapidly within a few hundred years. And so what's going on today is that there's steady growth in the world population for two factors: the population, the birth rate, the reproduction rate, and then also people are living longer because of modern conditions. So that's why the Earth is growing in population. However, that could terminate overnight by a single event. I'm not going to go into what events could do that, but the world population is very delicate, and it could be that the world population would go under very quickly, including man-made conditions brought on by man himself. In fact, this was a long time ago. I was on the radio show with George Norrie. And he asked me, we were talking about Planet X and things like that. And he said, what's the biggest thing that man faces today, the biggest danger? And I just said, man himself. Man is his own biggest enemy. And it's true. Even today, that was maybe 10 years ago or more. But I remember that. And literally, that's the situation, that man is his own biggest enemy and could greatly affect the population of the Earth overnight. Okay, I want to switch gears a little bit here. There's some topics I want to cover. Solar panels. Interesting that Italy has banned solar panels on what they call agricultural land. So this would be like land that is zoned for agriculture. And there's some clear issues with solar panels being around anything agriculture. I'll go into that in just a minute. However, Rome, which of course is a major city, triples its commitment to renewables, which of course in Italy would mean, because there's not a lot of wind in Italy, in the main part of the island, or the peninsula, I'm sorry. But so that would mean primarily solar, which of course you would think that Italy would be a good place for solar. But so they have these competing parties, one seeing solar as not beneficial, as actually dangerous in regards to agricultural land. So what is the problem? Before this, I'll preface this by saying that the University of Cordoba, they have a project where they're putting solar panels on ag land. So you have these conflicting movements within Italy between, say, universities. But now the ban, the national ban that was just voted in by the Conservative Party there, is talking about, they have exceptions. In other words, if money is coming for the solar panels from the European Union, then that agricultural land is exempt from the prohibition. In other words, they can put or will be allowed to put solar panels on that agricultural land. So there are some projects that are pure agricultural where in Italy they're going to ban solar panels now. So what's the problem? Why would they be doing that? Well, they, in a sense, they don't really say, but the issue is that the solar panels are at best about 20% efficient, which means they're absorbing light because they're dark. They're dark in color. So they're absorbing about 100% of the solar radiation, but only about 20% of that or less on a hot day. The hotter they get, the less efficient they are. So they might be down as far as 12% efficient in terms of turning the solar energy into electricity. But so that means about 80% of the solar light is going back into the atmosphere. So it kills birds. It's very damaging. And also that heat is radiated downwards to the land, basically killing the plants because it blocks the sunlight and gives off a tremendous amount of heat. So in terms of being green, solar panels are anything but green. You know, the people get the idea that this is going to generate electricity and that's good and we don't burn carbon. But the construction of solar panels is one of the most polluting enterprises on the planet. It's horrifically bad. Okay, the other issue with solar panels is that during the rain, chemicals are leaching out of the panels and falling on the ground. And these are not just any chemicals. These are highly carcinogenic chemicals that are leaching into the ground. So if you have plants that are being grown for, say, corn or wheat or something else, then those chemicals are going to go into the seed, into the corn, whatever, and then be consumed by people. And then this ongoing cascade, this ongoing transmission of chemicals into the population is going to continue. So one group is seeing this as a problem, and the other group is like, oh, just for the purpose of green energy, they want to put in a lot more solar panels. Eventually, it's going to cost a lot more because within 10 years, 20 years at max, all of these solar panels are going to lose efficiency down to the point where they're just not producing any at all, any energy at all. And so, you know, when they calculate the amount of energy they're putting in, so many gigawatts of energy, solar energy, that's a pie in the sky estimate. The actual amount of energy they're going to get out of this is about maybe 20% of maximum output. So it's 20% of 20%, which gets you down to 4%. And only after these are installed are those facts going to become obvious to the public. So solar panels are not a way to go. But these countries are energy limited, and it's going to be a solution that's going to come back and bite them, just like it has in the United States, where they've have power companies that have invested heavily in wind, and they're basically financially bankrupt because they're not getting electrical return back from those investments. Okay, so another quick topic here dealing with the solar flare. You may have heard about this. There was a X-class flare that went off the far side of the sun, but enough of it was, most of it was blocked by the sun. And so it was on the far side of the sun, but a little bit of it had an X-ray signature and ultraviolet light signature that was very visible from Earth and affected shortwave radio, ham radios, other radio transmissions that depend on the ionosphere. So it was transmissions were disrupted for a period of time. I think it was back on the 11th, I think the May 11th. It caused auroras as far south as the southern United States. And you can go online and see pictures. People took pictures of the aurora borealis, the northern lights, which typically you only see if you're up beyond the northern border of the United States. You have to go up into Canada to see it regularly. Say you're in the northern states, Dakotas, Minnesota, northern Wisconsin, northern Michigan, you can see them a few times out of the year. And so that's a little unusual, but normal. But to see them as far south as, say, the Grand Canyon or other locations like that, very unusual. And so they don't know what's going to happen. This flare source, it's a very large coronal hole in the sun, is actually spinning around the other way. And so Earth is not going to catch up. It's not going to catch up to us. And we'll see as it comes around the other side of the sun, as the sun rotates, is it going to affect Earth? Is it still going to be active? Potentially not. That would be a very long time for the sun, for a solar flare to be active like that. Okay, so anyway, you may have heard about this. And apparently there was just a slight glancing blow, because when these things blow up, they blow up in three dimensions. And of course, if the sun's in the way, that's absorbing anything in that direction. And then pretty much sideways outwards in 360 degrees in a big circle. And that was the case with Earth, as we were just on the backside of that circle. So we caught a little bit of spray, you might call it, off of this X-class solar flare. And of course, those will increase in frequency as we move into this upcoming solar cycle. Just a quick comment on some launches that are going on. Boeing Starliner is to take astronauts. This will be the first attempt of this particular spacecraft and launch system to take astronauts to the International Space Station. But it's been delayed. It was delayed earlier, I think like May 8th, earlier in the month of May. It was delayed because of some kind of valve issue. Okay, so a couple of days ago, yesterday, the day before, it was delayed again until May 21st because of a leak in the propulsion gas system. So anyway, I'm not giving out all the details of these, but the idea is that I just have this feeling that, of course, a big company like Boeing, which is having major problems with some of its aircraft because they wanted to get them to market, because a company like Boeing, it works on profit, works on getting to market on time, and that's a big push. Where safety can be compromised, that's all I want to say about that. Whereas with SpaceX, SpaceX is reaching its 50th launch of the year, which is incredible. In the last couple of days, they had a launch from the Florida compound or the complex, and then hours later had a launch from the California complex. And this is for the Starlink program to put dozens of small satellites into space for the Starlink program. And of course, what was it, a week ago, they sent a group of people to the International Space Station. And this is getting to be standard fare for SpaceX. 50 launches in 1 year. That's more launches than NASA had since the beginning of the space program, when you go back to the Mercury system. So, where we would wait 6 months, sometimes a year, sometimes 2 years for a launch from NASA. And SpaceX has 50 launches in this year. This is what should have been going on. If we would have had this from the early 1970s or 60s in the NASA space program, we would have had, by the year 2001, we probably would have had orbiting space stations, like in the Kubrick movie, 2001. So anyway, but leave it to a private company because I consider Boeing part government. But make no mistake, SpaceX has received its share of benefits from big investments, like the Google and Fidelity investments that occurred a number of years ago, $2 billion with a B. So I wish my companies would get $2 billion input. It would really be nice. But you can do a lot with a few billion dollars input into your company overnight. You can hire good staff. You can take the good engineers away from these other companies. You can be a lot of things, because space always was easily accessible. It's just that under the NASA government model, where only government-sponsored programs can go into space, it just turned into a pork barrel. That's all. It was a giant money funnel for all these large corporations, and it was to their benefit to not go into space. Every time they went into space, there was risk of failure. Why do that when you can convince the public that it's got to be 2 years between launches? So anyway, finally, some activities going on in outer space, but make no mistake, the Chinese are very advanced, and they're all over the moon. Like I said before, when NASA ever gets to the moon, if they ever do again, they're going to be able to step out of their spacecraft and go down the street and buy Chinese takeout. That's the level that it's at. Okay. I want to talk about an astrophysics topic here. One of those contradictions that comes up about once a week when you're dealing with Big Bang, crazy technology, or crazy theoretical work. In supposedly the Big Bang, you've all heard about that. The universe starts, and 13 billion years later, you're driving your SUV up and down the road. That's the scenario. Okay, well, it never made any sense, really. It was always like, as Nikola Tesla said, a mathematical hyperextension of theoretical work that has nothing to do with reality. But the latest thing is what they call population 3 stars. Now, population 3 star is a star that would have developed soon after the Big Bang. There was purely helium and a little bit of hydrogen, so a purely hydrogen star. And these are big, very intense stars, which makes you wonder, how are they burning? There's no core in these stars. There's maybe a little teeny core of some kind, but primarily it's just a big ball of hydrogen, and it's burning intensely. So that's one of the first contradictions, is because with our sun or any other stellar model, you need some kind of core where the fusion takes place, and these stars don't even have a core, yet they're the hottest, brightest stars in the heavens. Okay, and supposedly the story is that these then generate, through nucleosynthesis, the generation of the heavier atoms. It's the fusion process develops the helium from hydrogen, then deuterium, and then goes on up to the calciums and the all the way up on to iron, etc. In the process, the entire spectrum of elements in the periodic table. That's the story. So if you find a star that's pure hydrogen, that would imply that by that model, that would imply that was near the creation of the universe. Because even though it's the biggest, hottest, brightest star in the heavens, it has not started up the chain of creating larger molecules or nuclei. Okay, well, that's the story. But now they're finding these out our own back door, just in the Milky Way galaxy. Well, how can that be? Because unless we happen to be where the Big Bang was, and by measuring redshifts, etc., they estimate that the Big Bang happened 13 billion years ago, and that the light is coming from 13 billion years, meaning we're at the edge of the known universe, supposedly, then there shouldn't be any hydrogen population 3 stars near us by any stretch of the imagination, but they're finding them, not only a few, but a lot of them. So once again, you hit this contradiction in theoretical work within the Big Bang community, and they are not intelligent enough to see that this completely destroys the Big Bang concept, along with the James Webb telescope. This is all data coming from James Webb telescope, along with finding fully developed galaxies 13 billion years away, light years away, fully developed galaxies just like our own, just like the Andromeda, which is our neighbor, fully developed galaxies which would be impossible in a Big Bang scenario. So this is two indicators that the whole Big Bang concept, and I kind of see some people migrating away from the Big Bang concept as they talk about trillions of galaxies and the infinite universe. I see some people migrating away from that, which, you know, if they want to be around in the future, they got to do that, because the Big Bang never made any sense. It was always hyper mathematics and extending to all of these results, which get more nonsensical as you get farther and farther along in the peer-reviewed journals dealing with the Big Bang. Okay, I got about a minute and a half left here. I just want to remind you, go to my web pages. JMCCSCI.com is the major web page. All of my books, CDs, DVDs, all downloadable now. So that's a new view on the webpage. So JMCCSCI.com. You can get to the water filter page. You can get to the grow tower pages from there. Also, you can get to the information about the wing generator, my education course. So that's all available there. And the water filters, I want to just reaffirm that the water filter sale is still on for the MR5 whole house water filter. It's called the Best Deal, $350 off, and you get another 5% off using the coupon code JMCC, my initials. JMCC, get another 5% off. And once again, the webpage, JMCC Water Filters. I also have the replacement filter elements for the what are known as the gravity water filters that are out there, the stainless steel containers. One sits on top of the other one, and you pour the water in, and by gravity filters down. My HI filter elements are the best on the market, by hands down the best, and they're the least expensive. A 4-pack for $189 or 10-pack for $399, and the 10-pack you can get a discount too by using that coupon code JMCC, and of course always free shipping for everything. Okay, so I hope you find these shows interesting, and I cover topics that really affect your lives. I hope I'm affecting the younger population to understand that what you're being taught in school is complete garbage, unfortunately. And this is probably one of the only places on the planet that you're going to get real information. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.